In honor of Jewish Book Month, participating Jewish bookstores across the country are offering at least 20% off all Koren, Magid, and Toby Press titles. This week, until November 8th, is Koren Booksellers Week. Check out sales at the following stores. In New York, Dar Ladar in Rochester, J. Levine & Company in the city, Yussel's Place in Merrick. In New Jersey, Chai Judaica in Milburn. In the Boston area, Israel Bookshop in Brookline. In Connecticut, the Isabella Friedman Retreat Center Bookstore. In Columbus, Ohio, the Breslov Judaica Gift Center. In the Philadelphia area, Bala Judaica and Bala Kinwood. In Chicago, Rosenblum's World of Judaica. In Los Angeles, Israel Connection Corps and the Mitzvah Store and the Mitzvah Store 2. Also online at Nahora.com. Check it out. All Koren, Magid, and Toby Press titles at least 20% off between now and November 8th during Koren Booksellers Week. You're listening to the Nachum Segal Network. We call this program By the Book. Our friends at Koren Publications keep us up to date on everything that's the latest and greatest in the world of Jewish publishing. KORENPUB.com. KORENPUB.com. That's where you could find a whole array of great works. And today we're going to be speaking with Joshua Halberstam, who is author of The Blind Angel, New Old Hasidic Tales, a Toby Press release. You'll find it on Toby Press, which is, of course, an imprint of Koren Publications. You can go to tobypress.com for information about this one. Again, it's tobypress.com for information. Joshua Halberstam grew up in Borough Park, Brooklyn, where both his grandfathers were Hasidic Rebbes. He continued his Talmudic studies in rabbinical school and received his PhD in philosophy from NYU. In addition to his academic and literary writing, he has written many books for the general reader, including Everyday Ethics, Work, Making a Living and Making a Life, Schmoozing, The Private Conversation of American Jews, The Guide to a Community College, and the novel A Seat at the Table. He's taught at NYU and Teachers College, Columbia University, currently a professor at BCC City University of New York. He teaches philosophy and communications and is no stranger to both television and radio. Joshua Halberstam, welcome to the Nachum Segal Network.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I greatly appreciate it. So I'm thinking that I should just ask you to allow me to sit back and relax, and you'll tell me some new old Hasidic tales.
Ah, that would be nice.
How does one become a Hasidic storyteller?
Well, if you're a Hasid, you're a Hasidic storyteller. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about Hasidic stories. Whereas from the get-go, I mean, when Baal Shem Tov started, his main way of proselytizing for Hasidism was to tell stories. So storytelling was always part of the Hasidic movement. However, beyond that, Hasidic stories became very unique in this way. They became not only a way of introducing Jews to Hasidism, but the story itself became a sacred act. And that never happened before in Jewish literature, but the story itself became. There's a very, I'll just tell you a very well-known story about the Rishna Rebbe, who was, and this is capsulizes what this is about, is he was, in the early morning, he was telling Hasidic stories to his Hasidim. And one of his Hasidim came over to him and said, Rebbe, it's time to daven shacharis. We got to go daven. And he said, what do you think we've been doing? Storytelling is davening.
Storytelling is a ritual.
It is a ritual.
One as important as davening.
Ritual,
right, a sacred ritual as important as davening. So it's about transmitting lessons. Yeah. Transmitting history, I guess, to a degree, right? There's often references to people and episodes that have already occurred, right?
Right. So it's about Rebbes, but it's also, and this was also distinctive about Hasidic stories, the heroes can sometimes just be a very plain, pious Jew, and not only the Hasidic Rebbe. But the, you know, all the classic stories are about this poor Jew who eventually, through his devotion, succeeds in satisfying a very dire situation,
right,
or raging poverty, whatever. So that
Or is the subject of a miracle, or he himself performs a miraculous act.
Right. That's right. And that was different because this is unique, and because this has never occurred before in storytelling.
All right. So who was your father? Tell us.
So this is an interesting for me. Doing this book was a lot of fun. A lot cheaper than doing therapy. Doing your father's stories, it's a lot better. Let me tell you. Well, You know, my father came here from a small shtetl in Poland, and where he heard all these stories, and came here with his father back in the 20s and became the first Hasidic Rebbe in Boropuk. Then he went back to Poland, and then came back to the United States a couple of years later, luckily, otherwise he wouldn't have made it. And he was very interesting, interesting man in a lot of ways, besides being growing up in a Hasidic world. And one of the cool things about our family is we can trace our heritage back, lineage, to the 15th century, because everybody was a rabbi, nobody worked. They're all Rabbanim, right? So, but they're all listed all the time. So when he came in fact, when he married my mother, I was...
Also from a Hasidic background?
Oh, yeah, my mother's father was also Hasidic Rebbe. She's a Rokeach, and Belzenigal, and they're all related. You know, we're, as biologists, look at our family tree, and they say you're genetically like bingo.
Right, so as far apart as you think you are.
My father and mother were second and third cousins, like five ways. When they got married in Williamsburg in 42... It was the first major Hasidic wedding in the United States.
How many people attended? Any idea?
A couple thousand. But there were my mother, I see pictures of my mother walking up to the chuppah with three policemen because it was a big deal. Now we have family weddings, as you know, like in Satmar, with my cousin, 22,000 people show up. Major catering events.
What they serve at your parents' wedding.
Yeah, I mean, probably not. Maybe a little piece of herring is my guess. So when my father, who always had a very literary bent, so he started newspapers, and he actually was a correspondent for a Warsaw Yiddish newspaper while he was here in the United States, and wrote these stories. I mean, his day job was he was the executive director of an organization called Ramei Balanes.
Oh, sure. Many have heard of this.
Right. But he, so he had this whole tradition of, but he was also very interested in literature. He told me a story once that he was... in Cheder, in Poland, in Shtetl, and somebody got a hold of an atlas. I don't remember why. And there were all these, you know, the boys standing around. And at that time, the Chinese wore, Chinese boys wore what they call tseplich in Yiddish, these long braids down their back. And my father remembers twirling his payas, and all the boys were, and looking at how weird these Chinese kids looked, you know, while he's twirling his payas. And he kind of had a sense that there's an outside world, and he got very interested in reading literature, and particularly in anthropology. So here's this Hasidic man, my father, but really had this interest in literature as such and good writing. So he started telling these stories on the radio. Now, the stories were, this was interesting because, if I may, just for a second, EVD, which stood for Eugene V. Debs, who was the socialist leader, the radio station itself began as a socialist radio station in 1928. They had FCC problems, and they sold it to the Forward.
Right.
And it became the largest ethnic station in the United States. People forget that in 1938, 11 million people spoke Yiddish as their lingua franca. Right. That's more than Hungarian and more than Dutch. I mean, and yeah, we can go on Sweden, the Swedish and Danish. I mean, this was a major, like Greek, it's a major language. Of course, in America, they started assimilating, and the language started dwindling, and you weren't going to get a new influx of speakers because of the Shoah. But Hasidim, who came here after the war, forced the EBD to change their radio program a little bit. I'm sure you know that there's not a lot because you're in
well, I'm
business.
A little too young, but that's interesting. I didn't realize it was their influence that made the transition.
It started. They were from Jews coming here, and the old Yiddish guys are all dying out. So
that's when Talmud starts on the radio and things
like that. And that's when the Talmud started on Saturday. You know, Moshe Shabbos, they had this, you know, Shir. And this became really new. And Jewish music, you know, your predecessor, started playing music. My father started telling Hasidic stories.
And the name of the show was?
This is interesting. The Yiddish word is Hasidim Derzelen.
Derzelen?
Yeah, which is untranslatable into English. Because the word Derzelen means ongoing telling, retelling. It isn't they just told the stories, they continue to tell the stories.
So sort of like transmitting Hasidus, like that type of thing.
Stories,
I mean, transmitting Derzelen, stories. Right.
So how would you translate? I mean,
tell a story.
It would be very clunky.
Right. I agree with you. It loses. I'm just trying to figure out where
what
it is.
So that was the show, right? And thousands of people, and I remember going to yeshiva in the morning. This was
where were you in yeshiva?
I went to Kamenetz high school at the time, and I think they merged with Samson's. Yeah, real Borough Park. That's where I grew up. So when I would walk, all the radios on Borough Park would be, right. be listening to my father, and I'd be late for yeshiva all the time. And I'm walking down the street. I hear my father's voice booming behind me. I'm looking around, and I'm feeling guilty. It's already late. But this was on EVD. But the translation issues became very interesting for me because of a couple of things. First of all, my father was telling stories to people who got the calendar, who got all the rest, you know, the connotations. I'm not writing this for Chassidim.
Right.
This is like the old Chassidish, like the original Chassidim was to write it for the world.
If you're writing for Chassidim, you'd write it in Yiddish anyway.
I'd write in Yiddish right. anyway. So I'm going to translate these stories. Now you get really interesting translation issues. Minyan, you probably can leave. What about Mincha?
All right.
What do you do here? Let me tell you some other issues. Very often in a Chassidish story, they'll quote a pasuk. They'll quote a verse in Hebrew. Now, if I translate that into English, the reader doesn't know whether or not I'm translating from Yiddish or from Hebrew.
Correct.
And you don't want to leave it all in italic. It gets cumbersome. There are other challenges. The real challenge is that you're translating from a culture, not just a language.
You know, it's funny. One of the problems is that you're a real author. Someone who is not a real author and wanted to be strict about what laws and rules he adhered to as he presented the work probably would do what you just described, would translate and not worry if they thought it came from Yiddish or Hebrew.
Right.
But you're a stickler for these things for obvious reasons.
You want to write.
Right.
I have a little leeway because they're folktales.
Right.
And this is not, you know, I've heard the same story about five different rebbes. I asked my father, Dad, did this really happen to this particular Rebbe? He says, I take the story and I pick the Rebbe whose personality.
You mix and match.
Mix and match. There's a lot of leeway.
Well, you know, people are listening to this conversation wondering if the blind angel knew old Hasidic tales are true stories, not true stories, or somewhere in between. You know, it's the most famous question always.
Right. You know what Hasidim always answer. Anybody who believes they're true is a fool. Anybody who believes they couldn't be true is a bigger fool.
Right.
That's the standard response.
They could have happened. Joshua Halberstam is here. The book is called The Blind Angel, New Old Hasidic Tales, translated and retold by Joshua Halberstam. Stories over by Tuvia Halberstam. It's a Toby Press release. Go to tobypress.com. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was saying there are some easier things about translating Hasidic stories. First of all, the weather, it's always a blizzard.
Why is that?
It's always freezing.
Why is there always 10 feet of snow on
the
ground?
There's always 10 feet of snow.
Why is that?
You'd think that in Poland it was never a sunny day.
July, they've got 10
July.
Feet.
Blizzards up to my neck. This was thin. So I don't like, so which means that in translating geography or meteorology, I don't have to know a lot of weather words because it's just cold. There's no flowers.
Right.
Maybe there's a rose.
Never a beautiful scene.
And there are no animals.
No sunsets.
A dog and who's dangerous and a horse.
Right.
And that, so you're
the Balagoa.
Right. There's a Balagoa and stuff. So there's already, but these stories, I must say, they range from...
And by the way, sorry for interrupting, but these are translated from his written work or from what was on the radio?
Yes. So here's what happened. My mother, you know, she should live and be well to 120. When she moved out of Borough Park to the faraway country called Flatbush.
Yeah.
So in Brooklyn. So she lived there for 50 years. And like everybody, you know, moving is like root canal. You know, you
go the worst.
The worst. But you go through boxes and you find stuff.
Right.
And I found this box where my father had typed the stories that he had read on the radio.
He scripted them for himself.
Scripted them. He's not going to, yeah.
Yeah, I understand. Some people would want to do it off the cuff,
right,
but he scripted it.
It's a long story. So I found this by 250 stories, which I read through, and then picked out 40 for this book. So there's a lot more to go, and it was really wonderful. Some of the stories he actually had published.
The show went till when? Till what year?
It started in the late 40s and went to the early 60s.
Wow, so a real run.
So over a quarter of a century.
Unbelievable.
Right. Yeah, and then he had an other Yiddish radio program called Gemara Kepluch.
Did he have a radio voice?
He was excellent. Really good. I mean, he was real, really fine speaker and good radio voice, which I can't mimic, but, you know, it was really good.
Now, how do you choose of the 250? If you just said you knocked it down to 40, that must have been quite a process.
It was quite a process, and it was a hard choices because they're really wonderful stories. Now, some of the stories, like Hasidic stories, tell about miracle working on the part of the Rebbe. But my father's own favorites were ones that were about the cleverness of the Rebbe, the wisdom, the psychological insight. He was much more inclined to those kinds of tales.
You in fact, have a couple of chapters, the Rebbe's insight, the Rebbe's foresight.
Yeah, you know, Rebbe's have a much more difficult time than therapists. I remember one of my uncles, the Blue Jiver Rebbe, telling me
also
that, you know,
irrelevant.
About this. And yeah, it's a great uncle.
Right.
So you don't want to hear this because my stuff with the
youth. So Visionist is in there also, right?
Everybody's
in there.
The only ones we're not related to. It's much easier to tell who we're not related.
Chabad
and
Square
and Gare. Square related.
Square, you are because Chernobyl, Square, all that.
Right. Yeah.
One of the seven cousins, all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, they're all related. Right.
But which one did you say? Chabad and Gare.
Yeah, because Gare is in Warsaw.
Right.
Lizia is Krakow.
Right.
So, although these stories, I mean, we have stories about in that book here about Lubavitcher, and we do have stories about the Gera, I mean, and a lot about Kutsk. So, it's a great inroad to, I mean, what I did was at the end, rather than a glossary, was have notes about the backgrounds of each one of these stories. And so that required a bit of research about this. But the stories themselves, you know, range. Here's what's, I think, innovative about these tales. People in America who know about Hasidic stories know them primarily through Martin Buber.
Or Shlomo Kalbach.
Recently Kalbach, right? And Eli Wiesel has some stuff.
Right.
I mean, Buber has these anecdotes.
Oh, the typical American with that, right?
American,
correct.
Right.
Correct.
So they'll read you know, those little anecdotal Buber stories,
right,
which in yeshiva we used to call Buber Mises. Yeah.
Right. No. Or at least the Rebbeim called it that.
Rebbeim, yeah. Rebbeim didn't know about Hasidus. Not my Rebbeim. I went to Lubavitcher yeshivas. So they would. There would be like smart little vignettes, anecdotes, but these stories have full-blown narrative arcs. So you get characters with conflict and, you know, it's emotional stuff that you don't get in these sort of analytic stuff. So that was, and people don't know about this. Because remember, most Hasidic stories were always written down in Hebrew, which made them into a sefer. So Nachum Breslov's stories.
Right.
The stories are told in Yiddish.
The Rebbe's Torahs.
But they're written down in Hebrew.
It would be in Hebrew, right.
Right. There were in the 20th century, you have beginnings of some people writing in Yiddish. We had a cousin named Nasha Unger who wrote a lot of stories, but generally, so it's already translated from the get-go from Yiddish to Hebrew, but the oral tradition really continues on. So telling the stories, in their original vernacular, my father continued that long tradition. And remember, what's unusual about Hasidic stories as his literary critics point out, it's the oldest, longest-standing genre of Jewish tales in history.
Right.
There's, the Hasidic story has not changed in hundreds of years. The structure's the same. In most stories, there's a story within a story. The Rebbe tells,
or a dream.
Here's a problem. Let me tell you that. Right. So right. Some story, and the structure's pretty much the same, and that hasn't changed.
Unbelievable. Joshua Halberstam is here. It's called The Blind Angel. Why? Why is it called The Blind Angel?
Because, I was going to call it New El Chassidic, just use the subtitle. But I used the name of the first story, which my father particularly liked a lot. It's a really quite wonderful story.
And so there must be some stories that you heard him tell multiple times, to say the least.
Yeah, I mean, you would tell the stories on the radio, but I wasn't that familiar. Yeah, around the table, as I say, we would hear these stories. And I grew up with these, you know, Chassidic Shemasa, you know. And so storytelling itself becomes a really important part of the way one reacts to the world. Some of it's like magic realism, you know, which they use now in literary. But there's a sense of transcendental feelings. Hasidim always say the difference between Hasidism and Kabbalah is that Kabbalah brings people up to heaven, and Hasidism brings heaven back down to earth.
All right.
And that's what the story does.
So now, you alluded to this earlier, but just for a little detail, how did your father obtain all these stories? Was he as a youth sitting at the feet of Rebbeim hearing all these?
I'm sure. I mean, most of the stories, you know, they just were in the atmosphere.
Transmitted.
But I'm sure he found some here and there in different versions, took some liberties, I'm sure, with some as well. I was a writer, you know. But the kernel of the story was always there, and there were hundreds. I mean, it's a rich literary tradition that people aren't with. Now, Kalbach, as you mentioned, told some stories. It's unfortunate that people who are not in the Hasidic world don't know about these tales, you know, because they're, as I say, they're not just mussar, they're not just telling people what to do. There's an incredible richness there that I think is not well known enough.
I find, and I haven't read all these stories, but I find that what you've done in separating them into categories must be a difficult task, because a lot of these can go in multiple categories, so to speak, right?
Absolutely.
So there's a looseness or a little bit of a author's license in terms of how you categorize them?
Author's license and an editor. Yeah, we say, at first we said, this is ridiculous, I can't do categories.
Yeah, just print the stories.
Just print the stories. And they say, readers want things divided up. That, you know, we'll just kind of push one here and push one there, but you're absolutely right.
That's so funny.
I have no idea why they're that way.
So there's one on character and compassion, yeah. Right? Should I ask you to tell a story? What should I? I don't want to put you on the spot, but how do we get a taste of the?
I don't know how much time we have. I mean, if we have,
we certainly have a few minutes. Sure.
I could read a story.
Go right ahead. Which one would you choose? Joshua Halberstam is
very,
here,
very short.
Talking about the blind angel, the new and old Hasidic tales of his father, of Tovia Halberstam. You're listening to the Nachum Segal Network, and buy the book with our friends at Koren Publications at the Toby Press release. You can go to the web, tobypress.com, TOBYpress.com, for all the information regarding not just this book, but so many great books that they're releasing. Go ahead. What do you have for us?
Well, I'll read you a story, and I'll read it a little quickly so we
sure.
have enough time.
Yeah,
okay. I just picked the short one. This is called Chunah's Messiah. Now, when people read this book, you should be aware that the official YIVO declaration is that the KH sound is for Ch, unless it's a well-known name like Chaim or Hanukkah, where it's CH. But all Yiddish now is translated into a KH. So,
and the CH, again, except for those exceptions, would never be used.
Would not be used anymore. Writers. And this is a very big deal in translation issues.
I can only imagine.
Because CH people are, Americans don't know any Yiddish. They're pronouncing it as ch.
Right. So Chaim would be Chaim to most of them.
A friend of mine who used to do stand-up comedy told me he stopped because every time he talked about nachas, people asked him if that was a Texas Chinese, Texas
right,
food.
A dish.
Nachos, so you got to watch out with the CH.
Interesting. Okay, go ahead, sir.
Self-deception is the nastiest of illnesses. One's an old Yiddish aphorism. Pity those who, without warrant, convince themselves they are extraordinarily wise or handsome or good, or the familiar hypochondriacs who continually insist they suffer from a lethal ailment. But the disease of self-deception also afflicts those who are overcome by an obsession, a bizarre belief not about themselves, but about the world. Those who are, as they say, in the throes of a mishigas, someone like Chunah. In most ways, Chunah was no different from other Jews who lived in the town of Kalshin. An honest merchant, solid family man, and a dutifully religious Jew, Chunah struggled all day to earn a living and spent his evenings at the synagogue immersed in prayer and Torah study. It was this last matter, the study habit, that Chunah distinguished him from those around him. Ordinarily, a chassid's regiment was focused on Torah learning, beginning with the passages of the scriptures, then perusing a page of Talmud, and perhaps, if he was so inclined, dabbling in a work of Kabbalah. But Chunah ignored the standard text, the five books of Moses, the Mishnah, and the commentaries. Chunah was interested only in the Zohar, the esteemed classical work of Jewish mysticism. Alas, Chunah was no scholar, lacking both the depth and the breadth of knowledge that are the prerequisites for understanding this notoriously confounding text. The Zohar's profound metaphysical ideas, subtle analysis of language, and complex theosophical discussions of the Sfirot, the divine emanations that permeate creation, were simply beyond Chunah's grasp. Despite hours spent bent over in study, Chunah's understanding of Jewish mysticism remained limited to the folk traditions of Kabbalistic lore, the existence of Lamed Vavniks, 36 people whose concealed righteousness supports the world, that the letters of the Torah have the power to both create and destroy, that the divine spark dwells even in the simplest of people. Chunah was particularly enthralled by the popular teaching that the Messiah and his forerunner Elijah could appear at any time in any guise, as a pious tzaddik, but also as an ignorant Jew, or for that matter, even as a non-Jew. Perhaps in response to the stress of mounting business pressures, Chunah took to spending more and more time at the synagogue, concentrating even harder on the study of the Zohar, losing himself in a maze of esoteric ruminations he could not understand. Soon he began having mystical intuitions of his own. He dismissed them for the most part until one night, an astounding notion crystallized in his mind. In the midst of a deep sleep, he suddenly sat up in bed, possessed by the distinct knowledge that that the province's military commander was actually Elijah, and the Messiah was none other than the Starosta, the region's eldest administrator. Other than the singular eccentricity, Chunah conducted himself normally. If you had an ordinary conversation with the man, you'd never guess the secret he was carrying. But should the discussion turn, as it sometimes did, to the hope for the coming of the Messiah, Chunah's eyes would glisten, and he would put his finger to his mouth and drop his voice to a conspiratorial whisper. "I have something to tell you," he'd begin. "You think the general and the starosta are who they appear to be, Gentile government officials? Well, they aren't. In fact, the general is Elijah, the forerunner of the Messiah, who in turn poses as a starosta." Chunah would then reveal the proofs of his discovery, reading various meanings into the words or actions of the said officials. "Yes, they seem ordinary," he'd tell his audience, But don't you see these are really signals? Soon, very soon, their true mission will become clear to all. For the townsfolk, Chunah's fantasy became a source of endless mockery. But for Chunah's wife, these bouts of insanity were hardly amusing. She was stung by the smirks and ridicule, but even more by her husband's flight from reason. She pleaded with him to be done with this absurd notion of his, or at very least to cease mentioning it to others, but Chunah would not be persuaded. "I know people think I'm crazy," told his wife, after a particular tearful entreaty, "but let me assure you that I'm the normal one here. You'll see, soon enough I'll be vindicated." Chunah's wife, frantic for help, sought out the best medical expert she could find. Her adamant husband, as you'd expect, declined to accompany her on these consultations. It was just as well. These visits proved futile in any case. The doctors merely shrugged and admitted that solving mental aberrations of this kind was beyond their capabilities. The desperate woman decided to call on the great Hasidic leader, Simcha Bunim of Pshischa. Although her husband maintained that he did not require any help at all, a visit to the great rabbi was not something he could refuse. Chunah's wife had arranged to speak to the Rebbe first in private. Dabbing her eyes with a handkerchief, she told the Rebbe of her husband's idea about the Messiah and the damage this was wreaking on his reputation. "No one had any idea, has any idea how to cure him of this delusion," she told the Rebbe. "Please help restore him to his senses." When it was Chunah's turn to speak with the Rebbe, Rebbe Simcha Bunim greeted him warmly, engaged him in friendly conversation. Only after he was sure his visitor was at ease did the Rebbe steer the conversation to the sorry state of the human condition. "Ah, such trouble," said the Rebbe with a prolonged sigh. "When will we be worthy finally to experience the coming of the Messiah?" As if on cue, Chunah raised his hand to his mouth, his eyes assuming the wild glazed look that mention of the Messiah always provoked. "Rebbe," he said in a hush voice, "we've already proved worthy. Yes, yes, Elijah and the Messiah have already arrived." "Really? They've arrived? And you know who they are?" the Rebbe exclaimed, feigning surprise. "Yes, I do," Chunah said. "Perhaps through my study of Kabbalah, I've been able to make this discovery. Elijah is the military commander of our region, and the Messiah poses as the starosta." The Rebbe looked directly at Chunah, meeting his eyes. "Rebbe Chunah, since you seem to know so much, tell me who I am." Question bewildered Chunah. "I don't understand," he stammered. "Who are you? You are, of course, Simcha Bunim Pshischa, the holy tzaddik of our generation." "Well then, Rebbe Chunah," said the Rebbe, his eyes still focused on Chunah's, "if I am, as you say, the tzaddik of our generation, do you not suppose that I too know the little secret identities of the commander and the starosta?" Chunah nodded his head slowly, arriving at the inevitable realization. If he, a simple Jew, had discovered the confidential identities of Elijah and the Messiah, then surely the great Rebbe Pshischa must be privy to this information as well. "I'm sure the Rebbe knows who these men are," he admitted. "Precisely," said the Rebbe, "but listen carefully. Why you have been granted this clandestine information, I cannot say. What I do know is that it's too early to unveil the true mission of these men, and you too, Chunah, must keep this a secret. This must remain between us alone. Do you understand?" "I do," said Chunah gravely. "Until the time is appropriate, I will not disclose what we only know." A smile crossed his face. "This is a secret known only to the Rebbe Pshischa and me." Chunah kept his word. When his acquaintances tried to goad him into commenting on the doings of Elijah and the Messiah, or on whether the commander or starosta had provided any new hints of their covert identities, Chunah refused to be provoked. "Enough with this nonsense," he'd say, and move on to another subject. As time passed, the townspeople stopped bothering to engage Chunah on the subject. He'd recovered from his obsession, they concluded, and happily welcomed back into the community. For his part, Chunah gave no reason for them to assume otherwise, all the while relishing his self-control and keeping his momentous discovery all to himself.
Phenomenal. Phenomenal. And that translation must have been difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, just one story from the Yiddish must have been a lifetime of work.
Yeah, I think my father would be pleased because he wanted these stories translated. And again, this is not about a moichvis, you know, it's not a mystery kind of thing, but it's
great one
about the Rebbe. So
it's a great one. The brilliance of the Rebbe.
Yeah, the innovation of the Rebbe.
The Blind Angel, everybody. It's Joshua Halberstam, TobyPress.com is all the information, TobyPress.com. We call this segment By the Book here at the Nahum Segal Network. I thank you so much for being here today.
It was so much fun being here.
I appreciate that very much. The Blind Angel, check it out. The new old Hasidic tales, Rabbi Tovia Halberstam, translated and retold by Joshua Halberstam. By the Book with you every single week right here on Wednesday at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time at the Nahum Segal Network. In honor of Jewish Book Month, participating Jewish bookstores across the country are offering at least 20% off all Koren, Magid, and Toby Press titles. This week, until November 8th, is Koren Booksellers Week. Check out sales at the following stores. In New York, Dar Ladar in Rochester, J. Levine & Company in the city, Yussel's Place in Merrick. In New Jersey, Chai Judaica in Milburn. In the Boston area, Israel Bookshop in Brookline. In Connecticut, the Isabella Friedman Retreat Center Bookstore. In Columbus, Ohio, the Breslev Judaica Gift Center. In the Philadelphia area, Bala Judaica and Bala Kinwood. In Chicago, Rosenblum's World of Judaica. In Los Angeles, Israel Connection Corps and the Mitzvah Store and the Mitzvah Store 2. Also online at Nahora.com. Check it out. All Koren, Magid, and Toby Press titles at least 20% off between now and November 8th during Koren Booksellers Week.